This is Pamela Kuhn, and the curtain is up on Center Stage, the show about the arts and the artists behind their work. We are coming to you from the delicious art gallery of Alex Trimper in Greenwich, Connecticut. And with me is artist extraordinaire, Dimitri Wright. As we sit here in the midst of his glorious new exhibition, I would like to recall his philosophy about his work. Now, these are Dimitri's words. To be an artist is to search for what is good, beautiful, and true in life, while consenting to one's natural ability with joy and gratitude in order to share it with others. Now, Dimitri, as someone who knows you well, I would like to add my own words about you.
Okay.
Pamela Kuhn has this to say of Dimitri Wright: seeking a transformative experience through art motivates Dimitri Wright, whether it is in his own work or with all of his art students. His energy is that of a man filled with grace who lives his art and passion as one. Mm. Two very descriptive views of the special nature of Dimitri. And now it is up to the artist to share his heartfelt thoughts with his public. Dimitri Wright, welcome to Center Stage. It is such a delight, as always, to have you.
It's good to see you again.
It's lovely.
Right.
The first time we've done visual.
Yes.
We've always been in the radio station. Yeah. And this is an added bonus because look at what is surrounding us right now, your work. You know, while you sit here in this magnificent gallery, tell me your feelings right now, surrounded by your work. Not unlike Georgia O'Keeffe when she would sit in the middle of all her paintings before a show.
Mm-hmm. The first thing comes to mind is an athlete that just finished a marathon.
Of course.
Because getting ready for the show, I was still maintaining a full load of private lessons and formal institutional lessons. And so the prep for the show was around and about and within it. So it required a lot more of me. And many of these paintings were done as painting demonstrations during class. So I'm a teacher that likes to teach by example. So that is an honor, a joy, but it has a different type of pressure if one is just working solo in the studio alone.
Interesting.
So I was just more physically tired than anything else.
Really?
Yeah.
But when you're sitting here amongst all of this work now, is there, I mean, I feel, looking at everything, that there's a joyous nature to this room now. Mm-hmm. The color, the vibrancy, your heart.
Mm.
With that in mind, about thinking you've run a marathon, are you relieved? Can you sit back and enjoy the rapture?
Yeah. Interesting thing about joy is something that you can have in the midst of trials. Things do not have to go perfect in order for you to be joyful. That means there's a higher calling or idea that's supporting everything. So part of the joy is teaching students what's good and beautiful and true about Impressionism. For me personally, following the small, still voice within and marrying those two elements together so that it's seamless. I think that all science, poetry, dance, drama, what have you, is looking for the elegant idea. And I'm 76 now, and I think I've found that. And so I'm working within it and playing with it, and that's a wonderful thing.
Would you call that the revelatory aspect of making art, finding that sliver of truth, literally?
Yeah. In the Bible, they talk about the pearl of great price, where you sell all the others for that one pearl. You say, this is it. I think I can rest here. And if I have to repeat, practice, and sustain this particular thing, I would be at peace.
That's marvelous. Mm. So are there times when there is not truth in your work? Do you stand back thinking, no, wait, this isn't the truth. I haven't found that slice of beauty.
Yeah, that's part of life. That's why we need others to tell us when we left the path. that's when paintings blow up in your face. You know, things don't work. I remember I had one painting I told the class about. I got so angry with it, I took it outside the studio and I threw it on the ground and I put a ladder on top of it. Thank God we've been having a drought. So for 2 weeks, the painting sat there and it hasn't gotten wet. And I continued on with some other works, and in that, new revelations came forth. And as a result of calming down, but looking at things differently, the eureka factor, oh, what if I took this and added it to that? So I resurrected the piece, the Lazarus painting, stuck it back in the studio, and I saw that it still had some flaws in it that would be disruptive to the new idea. So I scraped down as much of the surface as I could, and then I proceeded with the new idea, and it worked. So once that piece was brought up to where I'm at now, I put it away and I haven't seen it since.
Interesting.
That's what painting racks are for, by the way.
Is that right?
Yes. I call it the cryogenics lab. You remember the $6 million man? He says, we don't have the technology now, but if we put them on ice, we may come up with a means to make things work. And I have had that happen. It's one thing for a painting to dry. It's something else for it to cure. When a painting is cured, everything which might be disparate, things which are off, but you know that it has come to a rest. Oh, in the same way that you let a steak rest. I'm sorry for the culinary things. All the flavors and things kind of come together. And I'm looking particularly about this yellow painting that's over on the wall over here.
Yes.
Now, with life experience has taught me that that's what happens. And some colors are more difficult to work with than others.
Okay.
Yellows dry very, very slowly. And if you don't handle them properly, they go flat. And it's kind of hard to undo them. To get any sort of depth perception with them is very difficult and problematic. So I'm enjoying this piece now, whereas when I completed it, I knew that I was on the right track, but there was discord there. Now it's harmonizing the way I want it to.
But isn't it interesting how a sense of discord or friction can oftentimes reveal great beauty?
Oh, yes. Yeah. When you start to play with opposites, things that don't go together, but at the time when you do put them together, it's still not working. They're vibrating and quivering on a certain wavelength, but you say, just give them time. Just let it rest. And also too, if you're really trying to do something new, you don't often recognize it. You can't see it. You're aiming at something that's not there yet. And your instinct may be the only thing that you have is that I have faith that this is going in the right direction. So let it move through time and space and myself, and then we'll rendezvous later, and then voila.
And that must be something you impart to all of your students.
Yes, you have to be able to take a long view.
I love that.
Yeah.
Do you ever have those moments, let's say, with that painting, that you literally sleep on it, and in the morning it looks completely different to you?
Yes, and sometimes it looks worse.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, this is particularly true with expressionist painting, I would say, is the most exciting, out-of-the-box, exhilarating of painting forms. It's also like nitroglycerin. You shake it the wrong way, it will blow up in your face. You could be 100% on with it in one moment and turn around and be 100% not. It's just very much like that because it's based upon emotions. Mm-hmm. See, when I do a classical style work or a representational work, it's based more upon reason and more math. These are the anatomical proportions. This is the chiaroscuro or the elements of light. This is this. Does it look like that? Here's proof. But when you start to work more abstract and more expressively, you look at it in one light, you see it one way. It's like the Rorschach inkblot test.
Yes.
Okay, so the psychological state that you're in will determine what you see.
How interesting.
So a lot of contemporary art, the artists are designing an event horizon where they become a facilitator and the onlooker fills in the rest of it. Mm-hmm. You don't want to spell out too much. So I'm venturing into that with some of these, whereas the representational works, I'll say, see this, this is this at this particular place and time, and look at it through this particular lens. So they're being guided through. The more abstract works, you're not being guided through.
This is really interdimensional.
Yes, and that's why some people prefer it. And it's interesting the way it stands relationship to the postmodern world that we live in now. Because right. when you had the classical realm, where you had an agrarian societies, and look at the way time and space move and the hierarchy of the church and aristocracy and so forth, and it was a system. And then as we move from that towards the craft guilds into the academy level painting, it was still very hierarchical, but artists that could achieve the highest level of ranking were like Olympians. Only the best could represent the king or queen or the church or nation state, and that makes sense based upon that. But since the Industrial Revolution, with the establishment of the middle class and all these type of things, things became more personalized. Mm-hmm. And which means that the individual idea or concept can be a thing of beauty in and of itself rather than pointing through a particular system.
Of course.
You know, so things start to spread out and atomize perhaps a little bit too much, right? So now that means when you start to move really towards the modern and postmodern ideas, do we have like bananas taped to a wall?
Of course, yes.
Duchamp opened up things and Picasso with the bicycle seat with the bull.
Yes.
You know, so that opens up the imagination in a whole new way. The Impressionists opened up that door.
So let's talk about this painting right
sure.
here. This is a graph, really, for what you're speaking about right
yeah.
now.
Mm-hmm. This is a teaching tool that I use called the Tree of Impressionism. The original idea was established by Esquire magazine in a portfolio about Impressionism. And they use that illustration as a mind map, so to speak, so you can visualize how does natural Impressionism, post-Impressionism, the different divisions of it all work together. I thought it was brilliant because when I first decided after the Academy that I would focus on Impressionism, the more I read the PhDs or the officials in the museums as to what is Impressionism and what's not, I was becoming more and more confused the more I read until I saw a visualization of it. I says, I can work with this because I like maps. So right down in the tree, this represents the Academy. That's what the Impressionists rebelled against. I was an Academy art teacher, and I was an Academy student, and I graduated first in class in the Academy. So as far as the Impressionists is concerned, I'm the enemy. But like many of the American Impressionists, like Julian Alden Weir, he went to Paris, studied the classics, he wrote a letter home stating, these Impressionists, it's worse than a chamber of horrors. Okay, so imagine this stuff was radical and avant-garde, but later he became an Impressionist. Well, that's what happened with me. And I saw in the heart, in the mind of my mentor, which was a cast drawing instructor, he taught strict mathematical element, but when he taught painting, it was more like Cézanne over here. So let me just give a global overview of how it works. So here is the Academy. Before that would be the craft guilds, and before that the Renaissance.
Yeah,
the grounding.
Literally.
And here we have natural Impressionists. So these artists are working all more representationally. They would paint via their sensations, the touch, taste, smell, scent. That's what goes into the work, and that's what makes Impressionist paintings unique, is that we work from our sensations. And the engine of ingenuity is plein air painting. And then as soon as we get up into these three branches, right over here, we have a fauvism, or the wild beasts. And so most noted would be Van Gogh and Gauguin. There are others, but those are the two giants. And here, Seurat would be king. And you would have this pointillist style. imagination and surrealism. So these works are looking very different than that. And this here is looking the most different of all, is the cubism, where you would break things into cubes or you would deconstruct it and create a whole new way of looking at things. Perhaps instead of trying to create a three-dimensional effect, maybe try to create a fourth-dimensional effect. So most notable would be Picasso and Braque and so forth.
Of course, I see.
And Cézanne. Now, right up in here are the children of Impressionism. And you can see that the branches are kind of mingling together. So the children are picking up influence from grandma, grandpa, mom, dad. You know, it's kind of spreading out a little bit more. I try to create a new branch, which is Transcendent Impressionism.
With the butterfly.
I added a butterfly because I'm not quite too sure yet. It's fleeting. Impressionists are interested in a fleeting moment. So here, the time of day, season, sense of place. Here, the heart. Here, the imagination and dreams. Here, the intellect. Mm. Here, transcendence.
And transcendence is your term.
Yes.
And I notice at the top, beyond the butterfly, the fig leaf, I'm going to call it a fig leaf, it strikes me as such, has no name on it.
Yes.
Is that left for you?
Yeah, that's, I don't know. That's yet to be determined. We'll see.
I think it is.
Yeah, the butterfly may go someplace else.
Dimitri, you're always so humble, and I adore that about you, but I think there might be a space for your name there. Mm. This is so interesting to me. You know, as one who admires art, this actually is very helpful for me in my mind to see how things are transcending.
Yes. Yes, things are transcending. And I think when I like to use a family approach. When I teach Impressionism, I see it as mom, dad, grandma, grandpa are at the table with the kids.
Yeah.
Okay? And we're all having a conversation together. Some artists have difficulty because they're trying to find their own way and they get into an either-or approach. But with Impressionism, I see it as an and-with approach where it's a blend of ideas. That's why in my paintings here, you see an array of different approaches. My works over here, which is the American Impressionist works, they are inspired by a pictorial idea. It's a sense of place of Weir Farm National Historical Park, the only national park dedicated to painting. I'm their master artist instructor, and I teach classic American Impressionist painting style. So that means the works are front-end loaded with mathematical perspective and aerial perspective. And so, yeah, you're beholding to getting some sense of order, but we're not too strict about that. But if I'm teaching more of a post-impressionist course, then it's not front-end loaded in the same way. It would be based more upon this internalized awareness about design and asking a deeper question, who are you?
Oh.
Yeah, which is deep. And out of that came this question, which I put to my students, which changed me. I asked a group of students, how would you paint if you had no fear? I remember making a lecture at the Silvermine Art Center. I felt the words leave my mouth, go over everybody's heads, and come back and hit me right here in the forehead. And the voice said, fool, how would you paint if you had no fear? Mm-hmm. And first a defensive reaction went up. Boop, 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 boop. No, no, just cut to the quick here. You're asking them, what would you do? And I said, well, I would do this, and I would do that, and I would do this. And then the voice came back and says, what's stopping you? And ever since that, my work super blossomed.
Has changed.
Has changed.
You see, this is what teaching does for an artist.
Oh, yes.
It runs through the genres. Yeah. Like you said in the beginning, when you paint for your students, it's different than you're working in your solo gallery.
Oh, sure.
It's a different pressure. But yet when you're leading others, you're divinely inspired. I'm convinced of that.
And you're taking people where they're at. Mm-hmm. You see, now, when I'm teaching an academy-style class with accreditation, the course is pre-set up.
Right.
And the goals and the targets are there. So it's more like archery. There's the target. I can hit it, and the top 5% of students can hit it. The rest of you have to catch up, and so that 5% would have to teach what's below. There's something elegant about that. It's like a martial arts or any other type of things. It's very, very clear, okay? And facts don't care about your feelings. It's a fact, okay? So with the more expressive element that's happening with the Impressionism, where are you?
Yeah.
I start the class with, what do you want and why are you here? I would never say that in the Academy. Mm-hmm. In the Academy, I would say something, congratulations, your portfolio has brought you to us. You see that we have some merit that we'd like to offer to you. In order for you to partake of this craft, it's going to require a great deal of discipline and sacrifice. Mm. Are you ready? See all these scared faces and things. Okay, then let's begin. So I remember with some of the Academy class, I would start out by drawing something close to a perfect circle on the board. I remember in the beginning, I was such a young teacher that I would have to get the director of the school to come in to stop people from laughing at me, because I would walk in and say, hello, I'll be your instructor, Mr. Wright. Get out of here. Phony, fake, fraud. They said, come back, says, you will teach them with all, treat them with all due respect. But yeah, I would start to do these type of things and impress people first, and then people would calm down. But with the Impressionism, there's none of that hierarchical element. I sit and listen to each person to find out where they're at within mm-hmm. the creative process, but also listen to their story. There's a narrative there, an incredible personalized narrative.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm blown away by this energy, as always with you. This is why everyone refers to you as so special.
Mm.
You're able to see that, almost with Cassandra-style eyes, you know, the goddess who could really, really see.
Mm.
And when you see all those faces, let's say, in your Impressionism classes, and you can see that some are just ready to jump right
into
their real voice.
Yes.
That is so risky.
Yeah, it is risky. I use a system, let me put this here, looking, seeing, insight, visionary, and inspired. Some people are already on the inspired level.
Mm-hmm.
When that happens, get out of their way and let them go.
Okay.
If someone is on the looking level, if I say look, everyone's going to go what? And I'll say, do you see that camera right there? Now at least we're communicating. So you want to be at least on the seeing level, and there are techniques to do that. If you're in an insightful way, you've internalized the subject and you understand it deeper and you have something to say, you can poeticize it,
mm-hmm.
okay? The visionary, you can project through time and space and see the future and paint that. That is profound. And of course, with inspiration, that's the highest calling of all. You do not listen to your teacher, do not listen to your mentor. You follow the small, still voice, and that will lead you in the proper course of action.
That's the truth.
That's the truth.
You speak about, which is real beauty.
Yes.
Because as an artist, you know, as a musician myself, we're always looking for the beauty.
Yeah.
I know I can never find perfection, mm-hmm. and in imperfection lies great beauty.
Yes.
For instance.
Yeah. Yes. And as striving for that, that means we wind up the residual is excellence.
I've got to remember that.
That ain't bad.
That ain't bad. I'll tell my own students that.
Yeah, because you have to practice. Because you can be talented, you can be gifted, but you must be practiced. And if you put all three together, you can hit a level of excellence, and it's a standard. And it's self-correcting, self-motivating engine. And you will discipline yourself, and you know when you're off.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's beautiful, but it's quite the taskmaster, because it's you. Well, you can't run from that.
But that's the best teacher, right?
There you go.
But then it's up to you to go deep inside to find out where that truth is.
Yes.
Or what is off? Well, how can we get it back on the rails?
Yes, right. Yeah, I like the word responsibility, but I look at it this way. Response able to choose your own response.
Oh, I love that.
That's from Stephen Covey's Seven Habits of Highly Effective People.
He
uses that approach. You know, so you should be proactive rather than reactive. And that is vital for creative, for just about anybody. With expressive painting, one can use that role of being reactive, where call response, so you can use it in a rather effective way. But at some point, you have to discipline yourself to know when the dance stops.
Right.
Okay. And it's very easy to miss your stop with that particular art form. Oh, so easy. With the more hierarchical approach, you have a target and you can see whether you're moving towards it or away from it. With the more expressive forms, it's you could be 90% on, and in the last 5 minutes, that 10% could totally dislodge and undo everything you've done.
Exactly.
Yeah. But yet, there are some people, they would not work any other way.
As you can hear, Dimitri Wright brings transparency and sublime honesty to his work. The benefits are wondrous to us all. He and I will be back next Tuesday for part two of this inspiring conversation. And in the meantime, you can go to DimitriWright.com to view a gallery of his works, learn more about his own philosophy, or even sign up to study with this fascinating artist. You can find the complete unedited version of this interview at CenterStageWithPamelaKuhn.com. I hope you will visit Dimitri Wright's exhibition at the Alex Trimper Gallery at 40 West Putnam Avenue in Greenwich, Connecticut. And the music you are hearing today is John Coltrane, one of Dimitri's favorite performers. Until next week, stay safe out there, everyone. This is Pamela Kuhn, and the curtain is now down on Center Stage.